This is Main Street Weekend on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our broadcast and online Main Street across North Dakota this Sunday morning. Prairie Public's radio network offers a variety of programming, news and information, and music. Last week, we featured music host Mike Olson's take on popular music. This morning, we'll sit down with classic music host Scott Prebis as he shares examples of the extraordinary pieces he came across during the past year. That's coming up after this news update from Dave Thompson.
The North Dakota House has passed its slimmed-down version of a bonding bill. The bonding bill is now $680 million. The bill allocates $435.5 million for the Fargo-Moorhead Diversion Project. Republican Representative Jim Schmidt of Huff says that would take care of North Dakota's obligations for that project.
In compressing this construction schedule, we're saving $20 million. And not only that, but you can't spend money faster than you can turn dirt. And right now, the Fargo Diversion is being able to turn dirt quicker. They have resolved their upstream issues. They have resolved the federal government's participation. There is steel in the ground and concrete on the girth. And the project is moving forward.
The bill also provides $74 million for the Mouse River Flood Control Project. The vote was 74 to 17, yet now goes to the Senate. As originally introduced, it was a $1.1 billion bonding bill. By the narrowest of margins, the Senate has passed a bill designed to allow for annual sessions. The sponsor, Republican Senator Brad Beckedahl of Williston, told the Senate this would be a short session to take care of any budget matters. He said 4 years ago the governor had to implement allotments to balance the budget, and he said he didn't want to see that again because those allotments are across the board.
The bill before us today would promote transparency and communication relative to our budget situation, better inform the full legislative body, and allow for an opportunity for all elected legislators to exercise their responsibility to vote on appropriations if needed. I urge a green vote on Senate Bill 2218. Times have changed.
Devils Lake Republican Senator Dave Elke argued against it.
It is not time for us to try to become or take a step in the direction of being full-time legislators. It would be very disruptive to our constituents back home. I don't think we'd be doing them a favor.
One senator was absent. The vote was tied 23 to 23. Lieutenant Governor Brent Sanford, in his role as president of the Senate, cast the deciding vote. The measure will likely be considered in the House, barring reconsideration. The North Dakota Department of Public Instruction has delivered a 26-page report to a North Dakota House committee suggesting ways to accelerate the learning recovery caused by COVID-19 and the move toward distance learning. Superintendent Kirsten Basler says tests show student scores have slipped during the pandemic. Basler says the suggestions were developed during a meeting of educators and stakeholders February 11th. A common theme, she said, surfaced among participants.
While our stakeholders were in favor of the premise of the task at hand to accelerate learning recovery in North Dakota and appreciated the ability to provide input on these ideas, it was clear that there was a high level of aversion to any mention of a requirement from the state as opposed to an option.
Among those suggestions, extending the 2020-2021 school year until June, beginning the 2021-2022 school year in early August with a flexible end date, developing a 10-month school calendar, Saturday school running 9 a.m. to noon, high-impact tutoring. The House Appropriations Education and Environment Division will continue its discussions this upcoming week. State Senate has voted to expand the Higher Education Challenge Grant Program to students who attend the two private universities in North Dakota, University of Mary and Bismarck, and the University of Jamestown. The challenge grants require the institutions to raise money. The state then matches it. For every $2 the institutions' foundations raise, the state will match it with a dollar. The bill has a $20 million cap. The amendment was offered by Jamestown Republican Senator Terry Wanzek.
Just because a student makes a certain selection to go to a certain school shouldn't mean that they as a citizen shouldn't share in these opportunities. And this challenge grant is, again, and I emphasize it over and over, this is for the students in these private schools. This is not to enhance the school, but to enhance the opportunity of students who choose these two universities.
Senators who opposed the amendment said the state had a long-standing policy of state dollars going towards state institutions. Here is Minot Republican Senator Karen Krebsbaugh.
I fear a bit of an erosion if we allow the two private institutions. Are the tribal colleges going to be next? What about the beauty training in the school, barber training, business colleges, and so on? They're all training our people. But how far can we go with this?
The amendment passed on a vote of 24 to 23. The full bill then passed on a vote of 29 to 18. This measure goes to the House. The Midwest region has some of the highest potential in the country for reducing its nitrogen pollution. As Harvest Public Media's Dana Cronin reports, a new study from the University of Vermont shows the region could do so without affecting crop yields.
Nitrogen is essential for plant growth, but it also contributes to environmental degradation, including reduced air and water quality. This study looked at nitrogen pollution hotspots around the country and then took into account social, economic, and agronomic factors that could make nitrogen reduction more feasible. Meredith Niles co-authored the study and says she hopes this helps improve nitrogen reduction programs.
I was especially motivated to look at this topic because we already have some of those programs, and yet they don't seem to really be moving the needle on what we need in terms of improving our environmental output.
The top states to tackle farm nitrogen, according to the study, are Illinois, Indiana, Missouri, and Wisconsin. I'm Dana Cronin, Harvest Public Media.
For Main Street Weekend, I'm Dave Thompson.
You're listening to Main Street Weekend on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Scott Prebis is a familiar voice to Prairie Public listeners who tune in our classic music service. He's the host of Prebis on Classics, weekdays on our network. Recently, he joined us on Main Street to share his discoveries and to talk about how his radio gig came to be.
I've always had an interest in radio. As a matter of fact, when I was going to school, we did not have broadcasting degrees. We had journalism degrees, but not broadcasting degrees. My love of jazz was a natural direction for my education, and I attended Indiana State University and the University of Colorado, and did my master's there, and then did some postgraduate work at the Eastman School of Music, and almost immediately was involved in broadcasting or recording one way or another, and it's always been there. When I moved here, news was just breaking that Bismarck was going to have a public radio station. And right away I made some phone calls and was a volunteer host for 15 years.
Wow.
doing Prebis on Jazz and subbing for our jazz host. At that time, we had jazz every night. And he would want some nights off, Brian Delp, and I would sub for him and loved it. And then took a break and then am back. In my rosy retirement years here and enjoying every minute of it.
You do Prebis on Jazz Saturdays at 7 Central on our network, but we're talking about classical music today specifically. What is the definition of classical music?
Well, you know, classical music, you can have a lot of definitions, but the most succinct definition for me is it's the music of great composers as performed by wonderful musicians.
Okay. That's a pretty broad field.
Well, the emphasis is on composition.
Okay.
The emphasis is not so much on the performer, although all those techniques and wonderful interpretations and understanding of the piece is left on the lap of the performer, but it's definitely the music of the composer. And of course, as the music developed, we have different periods. But the one consistent aspect of music through classical music through all that time, it's basically performance of music by composers. The main cog is the composer. And there's a little room for interpretation in that realm. Compared to jazz, an art form where the emphasis is not on the composer, but on the performer.
Uh-huh.
It's what the performer does. And performers quite often are not given that amount of liberty in classical music because of the guidelines stated by the composer, the tempo, the volume, the orchestration, et cetera. But the composer in jazz is almost not important. They play a simple melody, and then the rest of the performance is based on the improvisation of the performer. So classical music, music of the composer, jazz music, music of the performer.
Well, let's get some examples. You've got some classical examples you'll be sharing with our listeners today. What can you start us off with?
Well, these are all fairly new recordings, and one is on the Decca label. It's a brand new recording called Two Worlds. And as a matter of fact, they have a foot or 2 feet in both genres. Pianist Dave Grusin, who is known for his film work, plays piano. The epic guitarist Lee Ritenour, who has performed on thousands of recording sessions in Los Angeles, and then the former flautist with the Los Angeles Philharmonic, James Walker. So they got together, these three esteemed musicians, and are performing a piece by Manuel de Falla. This is a Canción number 3 from the Spanish Suite.
You know, Scott, I know that's a classical piece, as you set it up to be, but we had this jazz chat before that, and that almost sounded like a classical piece made to sound like jazz.
Well, you know, it's a wonderful time because Dave Grusin has a film composer's background.
Uh-huh.
So he's very adept at arranging in a contemporary vocabulary. Lee Ritenour, of course, has those rock and roll jazz roots, but is also a brilliant guitarist. And James Walker comes from a Philharmonic background, years with the Los Angeles Phil. And what makes that so pleasant is the current technology, the wonderful writing skills of Dave Grusin takes that older music by Manuel de Falla and gives it a fresh kind of look.
Wow. Well, those were virtuosos, weren't they?
Oh, absolutely. The amazing thing, Dave Grusin actively performing, the man is in his 80s,
uh-huh,
is still out there performing, traveling around the world. I don't think he's doing any writing for film anymore, but absolutely great music, and just released this year. That CD, by the way, is called Two Worlds.
Well, that gets to my next question, because, you know, Mozart, Brahms, Beethoven, you know, all those guys from a long time ago. How common are new classical compositions?
Well, oddly enough, it's great that you would ask that, because the new ones, I think, that are really fantastic composers are the equal to, putting my reputation on the line here, but are equal to those composers, but in a different genre, the film industry.
That's an important distinction to make because, you know, back in the day, back in Mozart's day and all that, there were operas and operettas and things like that. That was their visual entertainment supported by music. But now you go to the movies and that soundtrack is huge.
James Horner, Elmer Bernstein, John Williams, they are all legitimately great composers. And the best thing is that when they chose to write music, they chose the symphony orchestra. Uh-huh. They did not immediately move to, you know, synthesizers and just a small group of chamber players. So they have kept symphonic music. I don't know of a symphony in the country that does not have a movie theme night now featuring the music of these composers.
And that creates a kind of an interesting problem or a challenge for new directors of orchestras and symphonies that, you know, do we do a series, a season of the classics, or do we, you know, drop in this new stuff here and there? They have to be mindful of the audience coming with them, don't they?
And, you know, I think audiences enjoy both. I think the integration of the new music and the old music, and depending on what you select, audiences love hearing both. And I like nothing better than hearing Mozart programmed right after John Williams.
Well,
best of both worlds.
Set us up for another piece.
Okay, well, now we go back to the music of an American composer, George Gershwin.
Oh, boy.
And we're all familiar with his iconic music. We're going to hear a tune that he wrote called Fascinating Rhythm.
Oh, sure.
And Fascinating Rhythm is well known. Well, Shelley Berg, who is a pianist who teaches at the University of Miami, reimagined Gershwin's music. And this is Gershwin the way that he thinks Gershwin would love to hear it today if he were alive. Now, that's different harmonies, different improvisation. The world of improvisation has gone light years ahead from when Gershwin wrote music. But Gershwin always wanted improvisation. We need not forget that Bach improvised and Mozart improvised and Beethoven improvised. But Gershwin's music, when we did the cadenzas and the improvisation, we've kind of played it the same old way for the past 80 years or so. And this is called Gershwin Reimagined. We're going to hear Shelley Berg on piano, and we're going to hear an American violinist called Mark O'Connor. And this is a reimagined Gershwin of Gershwin's music with a contemporary vibe.
Scott, that's Fascinating Rhythm. How old is that tune, that Gershwin tune?
Oh, it's at least 80 or 90 years old. I like to think that Gershwin would be smiling if he heard the
piece. Well, that begs my next question, which I wrote down as I was listening to this. How do composers view new interpretations of their work?
Well, most of them are dead.
So yeah.
We'll never know, will
we? He's hoping Gershwin would like this one. And I did hear some arrangement in there that was very evocative of the Gershwin years. But I also heard some stuff there that was 21st century.
Well, Shelley Berg is tremendously talented, been on the scene for a long time. And, of course, he holds Gershwin in high esteem. But at the same time, it's time that we reimagine this music. We don't want to hear Rhapsody in Blue and those great Gershwin tunes the same way for 100 years. And this is that album. That album, by the way, is called Gershwin Reimagined. And the orchestra was the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra.
Wow. Now, is Gershwin stuff in public domain now, or is this all licensed yet?
Oh, I think that is in published domain.
So that the question gets to be when, you know, somebody like Shelley Berg gets a hold of a George Gershwin classic like this and kind of reorchestrates it, if you will. I mean, different instruments, different places, different rhythms, that kind of thing. Does that then become his property, his arrangement?
The arrangement does.
Okay.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. But, you know, what made Gershwin great is still there in the music. It's still Gershwin, those famous themes, those iconic musical motifs, if you would, are still all right there. Berg does not dispose of them, but he just enhances them, and it's great stuff. I absolutely love it. Again, just released last year.
Well, George Gershwin lived during the first international pandemic of our country, the Spanish flu back in the 1918 to 1920. Now we're in COVID-19 pandemic era. How has the pandemic affected the business you're interested in here, the creation and performance of music?
Well, I think it was a catastrophe for what they call the night economy, for concerts, for clubs, for entertaining, for dinners. What was devastating is that actors and musicians immediately lost work. You know, it didn't disappear in 3 months or 6 months. People were informed when they went to work in one night that we're done. You know, it's go home because it's over. Nashville, a city known for vibrant music industry, and a magnet for songwriters, they estimate 100,000 people in Nashville play music professionally.
Wow.
The $600 coronavirus supplement applies to some musicians, but not others. But the question is, when is it going to be safe to put 400 people back into a room, or 4,000 people, or 40,000 people in a room together? We don't know what that answer is yet. And musicians, by just the industry itself, are generally self-employed people. Some are independent contractors.
So-called gig workers.
Right, right. But some are employees of clubs and concert hall venues, and some are employed by the actual venue itself, like Carnegie Hall. You know, so they say now a third of British musicians are considering giving up their careers amid the pandemic.
My heavens.
And those numbers come from a musicians' union in England, from 2,000 members who were interviewed. 50% of those 2,000 members in the musicians' union in England have already found work outside of the industry. But we don't know what the impact will be for years, because now is the time when parents and advisors are saying, why didn't you pick a proper profession? I mean, you know, in acting or in music, Doug, you know, we've all heard that. Everyone knows this is a precarious, it's the starving artist syndrome. But it just adds more fuel to the fire of career logic.
Well, if Mom and Dad had made that argument that I needed to become a bean counter, I would have been out of work a long time ago, because the the calculator came into being. So we learn how to adapt. Creative people learn how to adapt. But those venues, like, well, you know, what happens to an organization like the Bismarck Orchestra that you perform with?
Well, it's very challenging, because we all know not as many people watch online. It's just not the same when you're hearing a performance on a computer, watching on a screen. What makes it doubly difficult is that the social distancing. I mean, being 6 feet. I mean, how do you communicate? Listen to the person next to you, whether you're in a symphony orchestra or on stage at a club, when you're 6 to 8 feet away. It's very, very hard to do.
Well, there's that, and there's that issue that there's probably a lot more air coming out of these people, too, because they're blowing into instruments, and, you know, a pandemic, a virus is, you know, we got to watch that. We have to be careful. But in the meantime, these places are under a lot of stress, a lot of financial stress. Performance venues are.
And it's just not the same when you're not performing for an audience, that whole adrenaline. I mean, you can put as many cameras as you want on stage, whether you're acting or playing an instrument, but it's not that you don't feel the adrenaline surge.
Well, let's get another sample from the Scott Prebis Special Classical Representation Day on Main Street file.
Well, our next artist is Lee Ritenour, a guitarist we heard on the first cut. And this is amazing. It's brand new, just came across my desk about 3 weeks ago. Lee Ritenour has made 45 albums of his own. He's received 16 Grammy nominations, has done thousands of recording sessions, including Frank Sinatra. But this is his first solo album with no other musicians. So 60-year career, and he's never made a solo album. Now, what complicates this is in 2018, his home in Malibu burned down, along with his collection of 100 guitars, 40 amps that he had, and, of course, these are the voices of his instrument. And then a week after his house burned down, all of those guitars and amps, 1 week later, he had his aorta valve replaced. So he came to the conclusion, if I'm ever going to do a solo album...
now's the time, huh?
Now is the time. So this is called Morning Glory. It is Lee Ritenour by himself, and it is his own composition, a man with a recording career lasting 5 decades.
Okay, Lee Ritenour, Morning Glory. He's been doing this for a very, very long time. That sounded, again, sort of improvisational to me, Scott.
And most of his ideas, he wanted to just go in the studio and play from the heart. And it was highly improvised, but the themes and motives were in his mind. And good to have him finally on record without anybody else. It's just pure Lee Ritenour. Thousands of recording sessions, but his first studio album in 5 years, but his first solo album.
Wow. And maybe his last one. We don't know. Huh?
Well, it's, for him, 2018 to 2020 was definitely not a good 3-year period. Next, music by Mozart.
Okay, well, we'll get to that in the second half of today's show. because we're talking with Scott Prebus. He's the host of Prebus on Classics. You hear it weekdays on Prairie Public at 10 Central. He's also doing Prebus on Jazz Saturdays at 7 Central. That's in the evening. And Scott, it's always a pleasure to have you on for this annual Let's Look at Trends in Classical Music discussion and jazz occasionally. But then we'll be back with you for more. But first...
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Josh Beauchet, realtor and broker with Hatch Realty, serving home buyers and sellers in the Fargo-Moorhead Metro, Grand Forks, Bismarck-Mandan, and Detroit Lakes area. Josh can be reached at 701-369-4839 or hatchrealty.com.
Coming up this week on the Thomas Jefferson Hour, well, I have some questions and I get to ask them, along with questions from many of our listeners.
Someone wanted to know what's the best biography of Abigail Adams, one of the most interesting first ladies in American history. I wanted to talk about the idea that Jefferson was impeached. Actually, he wasn't, after his disastrous governorship in Virginia in 1781. So we got questions from a variety of people on a wonderful set of subjects. This is an out-of-character show in which we try to answer as many questions as we can in the course of an hour.
And we end the conversation talking about Jefferson and his literary pursuits and tastes.
Thomas Ricks has a new book called First Principles about the founders and the classical world, and he has some relatively sharp things to say about Mr. Thomas Jefferson.
Please join us for all that and more on this week's Thomas Jefferson Hour.
Today at 11 Central, here on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined today by the familiar voice of Scott Prebus, the host of Prairie Public's Prebus on Classics, weekdays at 10 in the morning on Central Time. And we've been talking about classical music, the traditions, the new kinds of compositions that are out there, and, of course, the fact that people haven't been going to a lot of concerts, at least sitting in seats during the pandemic, but we hope that the vaccine will get us out of that. Scott, what do you want to talk about next when it comes to classical music?
Well, a remarkable Italian string quartet. They are called Quartetta di Cremona, and this is their 14th recording. It was just released this year. They are celebrating 20 years of making music together. This CD is called Italian Postcards because in Italy, music is everywhere. Now, Cremona is the site of some of the best instruments made, stringed instruments. Italy is a home for great instruments, Stradivari, and et cetera. So before we hear the piece, let me tell you about the Quartetto di Cremona. They play on remarkable instruments. The first violinist plays on an Amati violin made in 1640. Second violinist plays on an instrument crafted in Milan in 1748. The Terrazzi viola was crafted in 1680. And the cello is a scaglione made in Bologna in 1712. We are going to hear them perform the Allegro movement to Mozart's String Quartet No. 1. Thank you.
That was amazing.
The Quartetto di Cremona, and Mozart wrote this quartet, his first quartet, on his first visit to Italy. As is true with so many composers, they visit Italy and they become enraptured with the country and start writing music. And this group, their 14th recording, that CD called Italian Postcards. And what I find interesting, Doug, is we're using today's technology with instruments from the 17th century.
Yeah, that one violin is almost 400 years old. But as I'm listening to this, I'm thinking about Mozart. He's hearing this in his head, I assume, and he's putting it to paper somehow, making musical notation. Is there anybody who can play that well? how confident is he that there's an orchestra that can play this?
Well, you know, the interesting thing about Mozart is that from a historical perspective, we keep hearing about his keyboard skills and piano this and pianoforte this, and the movie was based on his keyboard. But he was almost as good a violinist as he was a keyboard player.
Uh-huh.
When his dad, Leopold Mozart, took him out on the road because the young Mozart was an asset to the family, not only did the young Mozart play on keyboards, but he also picked up a violin and play. And in one of his letters that I read to him when dad was away from the young Mozart, he said, you know, you really need to practice violin a little bit harder because you could become as good a violinist as you are a pianist.
Wow. And would he have conducted his own work?
Oh, yeah.
Because I just can't see him saying, no, it's got to be a lot faster, a lot shorter. You know, that's just an amazing piece of music.
Yeah, I don't know that we'll ever be able to fully understand the genius of not only Mozart, but Mendelssohn, who was another one of those precocious prodigies, you know, as a child. It's perhaps they were the true aliens.
And one of the members of this quartet is playing that Amati violin that was built in 1640. What is it about old string instruments, violins in particular, it seems, that makes them so extraordinarily valuable as they age?
Well, you know, in my conversations with people, some say it's the wood. Some people have actually said it's the glue that they used. Other people, of course, say it's the remarkable craftsmanship that goes into it. I'm not so sure that it's not a combination of all of that. But the instruments get better as they get older. They're finding that out in acoustic guitars, too, that the guitars, the Martin guitars from the 40s and 30s and 50s are irreplaceable because the wood is so valuable.
Wow.
That was a 1640 violin,
yeah.
Made in the same town that the quartet is named after, Quartetto di Cremona. And it's a remarkable CD.
How do you go about building one of your weekday shows, Scott? What goes into deciding what you're going to play?
Well, first of all, if I don't like it, I don't program it.
There you go. That's easy.
Why would anybody else like it if I don't like it? And then I try to create as much contrast as possible so it's not redundant. So we'll hear brass quintets. We'll hear symphony orchestras, a few vocalists, string quartets, solo piano, concert bands, everything imaginable to create a show that makes you want to listen and you don't get ear fatigue from listening to the same kind of music. At the same time, I try to include classical music and romantic music, sometimes Baroque, sometimes a contemporary, especially with wind ensembles, and that hopefully keeps it refreshing for my audience.
What do you consider the qualities of a good musical host? And I'm talking to one, so, you know, just to plumb your memory.
Three sentences or less
there
in between
go.
Selections, and keep the varied tempos and keep it refreshing for the audience. But a combination of old and new, which is why I love this Quartetto di Cremona, because they are brilliant musicians combined with the recording technology of today. And it's just the improvements in recording have been so remarkable in the last 3 or 4 decades. It's like I sit in the room and it's like I'm right in the concert hall.
When I was a kid, Scott, and that's been a while now, there were television and radio programs devoted to classical music. Nowadays, you typically find classical music on a public radio dial somewhere, like Prairie Public's. Do we consider the audience for classical music a given, or do we have to be aware of all those other ways they can access it now?
I think we need to be aware of our audience. The audience needs to be aware of us. If we don't do a good job, we will lose music. And that's been a great deal of discussion. Now, right here on Prairie Public, things have changed over the last 4 decades. And again, because we have people at the top of the chain that are constantly analyzing what our listeners want. And we, of course, seek audience input and do act upon their input. Every pledge drive, we do a lot of that. But it's ever-changing, and audiences are fickle. So we don't have as much opera as we used to have. We don't have as much jazz as we used to have. But again, the cycle is always changing, and as the audiences change. And I think that's true of operas, halls in town and clubs. It's the genre is always changing, and we need to be aware of it.
Well, we need to be aware of it on the Main Street side of our programming, too. We create a podcast out of each day's show because some people can't tune in at 3 or 7 for the rebroadcast during weekdays. And that means that they can access it whenever they want to. Is that something that's coming to classical music, where you just go online and download a show?
Boy, I hope so. I've thought about that, and our program director and I have talked about it. I don't want to, inundate the audience with that one. I think we're ready to we'll do it, and I think it'll be interesting. But I want to make sure we have the right show and the right audience. And it's something that's on my mind a lot. But podcasting is certainly, I do listen to podcasts every day, and that certainly is changing.
Well, I want to touch a little bit more on your background, because we are talking about classical music, and you've got some street cred here. You've performed with the Montreux Jazz Festival in Switzerland. You've recorded lots of times. You've worked with over 200 jazz and percussion artists during your long performance career, and you're a percussionist by specialty, and you've performed on over 150 percussion instruments. I did not know there were that many.
Well, a lot of them are small.
Well, I remember the 2 sticks in kindergarten. Yeah.
Before you know it, you're playing on 28 instruments and you don't know it. But it's a very diversified profession, and it's part of every single kind of culture around the world. So when you are a percussionist, you might be playing steel drums, embracing the Caribbean culture. You might be playing African drums, embracing that culture. You might be playing vibraphone. You might be playing drum set. If you love it all, you need to do it all. So at being a percussionist for over 50 years, I feel like I'm just now starting to begin to understand the profession and all the beautiful players that are out there, not to mention, Latin American instruments and some things that are just beyond at this point in my life, comprehension.
Well, when we started the show, we promised people 5 selections of classical music, handpicked, curated by Scott Prebis. So it's time for number 5.
Well, you're going to love this, Doug. For those of you who love Prairie Public Television and radio, music by the Scottish composer John Lunn from Downton Abbey.
Oh, boy.
Downton Abbey is highly recognizable, but it was on television for TV for 6 years, and then following the TV series, the film Downton Abbey. So John Lunn has been doing the music for 6 years. This is from the film Downton Abbey, and his music is as recognizable to our ears as Big Ben's iconic tower is to the eye. So from Downton Abbey, the movie, here is 100 Years of Downton Abbey.
That is evocative, Scott. As you were playing it, I was seeing those wide shots of the exterior of the manor house, and then I was going downstairs to the kitchen, and then that little piano thing comes in, and I'm hearing one of the daughters kind of playing with a piano. I mean, that's just the imagination I bring to hearing it, and that's what music's supposed to do, right?
And that's why John Lunn and the film composers are so brilliant at what they do. You are hearing what you see, the lush string sound, the prominent use of keyboard, and it all relates to that visual aspect of Downton Abbey.
And you got to wonder, it's such a collaborative thing to do a show like Downton Abbey, but the music is such an important part of it. When was he brought in, and how, you know, there are 1,000 questions that come out of that. Just the working together on something as complicated as that is.
And, you know, the music has a little bit of now in it, but it also has a lot of then in it.
Yes,
so
it
you
does.
Can relate to the period. So the music is both then and now. And that's what makes John Lunn just such a remarkable composer.
Well, let's look ahead. It's 2021. People are getting vaccinated. We don't know when we'll be at herd immunity. But any classical music prognostications for 2021, Scott?
I can't wait. Everybody is chomping at the bit to get going here. We don't know when concerts are going to start again. But I will tell you this, that during this pandemic, everyone, regardless of the genre, has been practicing.
Okay. Well, we look forward to the results of that practice. Scott Prebus is the host of Prairie Public's Prebus on Classics, heard weekday mornings at 10 Central here on Prairie Public. Thank you, Scott, for spending time with us.
Thank you so much, Doug.
Hi, I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why, Philosophical Discussions About Everyday Life. It seems like Congress can do something one day, but not the same thing the day after. Like the laws about loopholes and nothing else. Are we wrong to think this? Join me and my guest, P. Andrew Torres, as we explore the philosophy behind our legal system and ask, is the law consistent? On the next Why Radio, today at 5 p.m. Central, here on Prairie Public.
What do these people think of me? It's a question that can act like an anchor, dragging us down and keeping us from succeeding.
They might tolerate you out of a sense of, well, you know, we should, but could they really believe in you?
How other people's stereotypes about us get inside our heads. This week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Monday at 8 Central, 7 Mountain.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Winter can be a harsh season, but not everything is frozen or hibernating. Today, naturalist Chuck Lura reminds us of all the winter wildlife activity around us.
It never ceases to amaze me how quiet the prairie woods and marshes can be during the dead of winter here in North Dakota. Oh, there's the occasional sighting, such as that of a deer or coyote, plus the sightings or calls of chickadees, nuthatches, and other birds. But it often seems hauntingly quiet during the winter. That's a bit deceiving. A closer look reveals that many animals are quite active during the winter. I was thinking about that recently while taking a walk in the Turtle Mountain Aspen Forest. For example, tracks up, down, and around a beaver lodge revealed a coyote had recently investigated the lodge before continuing across a small lake. Then there were the distinctive deer tracks through the snow at the edge of a meadow. The deer walked along the edge of the woods, dragging its feet in the snow a bit, and occasionally going up to the shrubs where it likely nibbled buds and twigs before moving off again. There's also lots of sign of activity below the snow. Common occupants under this big white blanket include small mammals such as shrews, voles, and deer mice. They stay active throughout the winter. Occasionally I would see evidence of these animals, such as the top of an arching tunnel formed when they burrow through the snow. These tunnels may even open to the surface occasionally, perhaps with the animal tracks leading across the surface before disappearing below the snow again. Deer beds, or roosts of sharp-tailed grouse, are also observed occasionally, and rough grouse are known to fly into the snow to roost. I was abruptly reminded of that on an earlier outing when a rough grouse exploded into flight from the snow near my feet. For a second, I thought I was a goner. Those are just a few of the signs of animal activity during the winter in North Dakota. And there's no shortage of other signs. But to see them, one must get out and look for them. So make a point of getting outdoors to do some nature study this winter. There really is much to see, and it'll help you better understand and appreciate just what's going on out there. I'm Chuck Lehrer.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. Subscribe to the podcast or find past episodes at prairiepublic.org.
We hope you've enjoyed Main Street Weekend, and we invite you to join us for Main Street Weekdays at 3 Central, 2 Mountain, right here on Prairie Public. You can also listen live online and access our Main Street podcast anytime at prairiepublic.org. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your Sunday.